Welcome to Blogging Heads. I'm Harold Pollack. I teach social policy at the University of Chicago, and I am very delighted today to be speaking with you about disability policy and other subjects that might come up. So maybe we'll start, Sam, if you could introduce yourself.
Great. So I'm Sam Bagenstos. I teach at the University of Michigan Law School.
And you've done a few things in disability over the years, as I understand it.
So I've been working on cases involving the ADA as a lawyer since the early years of the ADA. I got my start as a lawyer in the early mid 90s when the ADA was new, and had got a chance to work on some of the early leading cases. And since I've been an academic since about 2000, I have been doing a lot of writing about the disability rights movement and the law as well, and had a chance back in the early years of the Obama administration to go as a political appointee to the Department of Justice and, among other things, supervise the enforcement of disability law there. I've had a number of different encounters with disability rights and disability law.
And I should say that what was the last case that you argued in front of the Supreme Court?
So the last case I argued in front of the Supreme Court wasn't an ADA case, but it was a case just this past term, Young versus UPS, a case on behalf of my client, Peggy Young, who was a driver at UPS, who, when she got pregnant, was denied a light duty accommodation, which is a kind of accommodation that UPS would have given her if she had any number of other conditions, but that they did not at the time give to pregnant workers. And we took that case to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court ruled for Peggy. So we were very happy about that.
So mazel tov to Peggy. There. This past weekend was the 25th anniversary of the Americans with Disabilities Act, the signing of it by President George H.W. Bush. And it seemed to me that it was noted, but it did not receive the kind of attention that many other anniversaries of similarly important legislation are noted. In particular, it seemed to me that sort of the usual liberal blogosphere, political activist community, this was sort of not a big deal to them. I don't know if you have the same sense.
Yeah, I think outside of the kind of world of people who are talking about disability all the time, you didn't see a lot of it. You know, unlike, say, we have the Medicare anniversary happening right now, and you see a lot of people who don't write about health policy writing about the anniversary of Medicare. I think it was really notable that you didn't see the same kind of discussion of the ADA, which has been a revolutionary statute, has its limitations, but has made a major difference in the United States.
Yeah, it seems even within the people who are major advocates for universal health care and so on, disability just seems to be in a different bin. And remember, there was a segment of the Affordable Care Act called the Class Act, which dealt with long-term services and supports in disability. And the Class Act, for complicated reasons, imploded and is no longer it really was repealed. And many of my friends who were in the trenches in health reform didn't know that it existed. And
yeah.
And when I talk to major figures in health policy, what should we do with the Class Act? Many of the leading figures pushing for it were kind of happy to see it go, and then we're distant from it. This was like the disability stuff is going to create all kinds of problems, and it's really not what this is about. And it's just sort of striking to me that the disability community internally has done a really good job of late in dealing with some of its internal coalition dynamics, but it's still this world that's kind of a little bit separate from the other political activist worlds that you might think would be connected to it.
Yeah, and I, you know, at some level, I don't even understand why that should be. I mean, you know, so you do see in the health policy world this sense that health is just very different from disability. And they're really very closely connected. Obviously, the limitations on the ability of people with disabilities to work are connected very closely to the lack of the kind of health insurance that enables people with disabilities to get out of the house and get on the job. And you know, the questions about long-term care. I mean, if you think about Medicaid, what are the biggest expenses under Medicaid? It's people with disabilities. So it really is, these really are communities that should be very closely connected. And sometimes I think it's just people come from very different perspectives. And so it becomes very hard to see, you know, from the perspective of people who think about healthcare policy a lot. They're thinking about this as a matter of treatment, a matter of care. And people who come from the disability rights world think of it as a matter of rights and empowerment and integration. And, you know, those don't always jibe very well with each other.
There's another, I think that's exactly right. And I'm sure that will come up in the conversation. There's another thing, too, which is the very reason ADA is politically incredibly successful is that it has a bipartisan origin, and many, many Republicans, Bob Dole, for example, you know, are strong supporters of it. And because it doesn't have that partisan valence in the current political environment, it's just hard to get people to sort of pay as much attention to it. It's sort of ironic. And maybe it's a good thing that people aren't paying attention to it. Maybe, many of the people that were leaders in getting ADA passed have said it could never pass now because it would become a politically polarized thing. But it's sort of weird that the very reasons for its success also provide us reasons to take it for granted and to ignore it.
I think that's right. I think that's definitely right. I mean, one of the things I found striking when I was working at the Department of Justice in the Obama administration was the number of Republican office holders who, you know, we would be suing or threatening to sue, and who usually would respond to the Department of Justice suing or threatening to sue them in a very negative way, you know, articulating a lot of states' rights kinds of arguments, who said, you know, this is something that's really important and really wanted to collaborate, wanted to do the right thing. And I think, you know, whatever people say about what would happen in Washington today and Washington's dysfunctional, I think around the country, you still have that bipartisan support for the ADA. So maybe it is a good thing that there's less conflict over it. There's still conflict, but there's less conflict than on some issues. And that's probably a good thing. But I do think it would be worthwhile for people to be taking more account of the changes the ADA's made and you know, the work that we still have to do.
And what do you think are the most important accomplishments of the ADA over the past 25 years?
I think the biggest one is just visibility and the built environment. I mean, so 25 years ago, people with disabilities were still, to a very large extent in America, isolated. It was impossible to get into many buildings. It was impossible to get around many cities because you'd get to the end of the curb if you used a wheelchair, and you'd be at risk. You'd have to be wheeling on the street if you wanted to get around anywhere, and that was risky. Transportation was totally inaccessible. Many public buildings, many businesses were places that people couldn't get to. I think now in America, we almost take for granted the degree to which, you know, there are still a lot of problems, but people with disabilities are all over the place, are taken for granted as people who are going to use stores and restaurants, who are going to go to the movies, who are going to do those everyday things that everybody does. You know, I really notice this when I travel to other countries, when you see the steps that those countries have taken are so much less. So people with disabilities aren't out and about. They're not a part of the fabric of society in the same way. I think that's a big deal in America. Obviously, educational opportunities have improved a lot for people with all sorts of disabilities in America. That had started before the ADA, and I think was part of what led the ADA to happen was earlier efforts to improve educational opportunities, which created this group of people with disabilities who for the first time said, you know, we have rights and we want to participate in the world, and the world is inaccessible. But I think the ADA has accelerated that. you know, I think the ADA has done a lot. I think, you know, what the ADA hasn't done is moved a lot of people with disabilities into the workforce. But I think in many, many other respects, the ADA has been of enormous importance.
By the way, who are some of the people that we should remember who helped make the ADA happen? And it seems to me that we don't quite have the same pantheon of heroes that we do for, say, the Civil Rights Act, or, you know, where there's a number of people that we could specifically identify as being pioneers in that effort.
Yeah. I mean, I, you know, that's one of the things that's really notable is that we can all name the heroes of the civil rights movement, you know, from Dr. King to John Lewis, to many, many others, you know, Fannie Lou Hamer. When we talk about the disability civil rights movement, I think most people don't really have that sense of the heroes, but there really are folks who, you know, starting in the 1960s and 1970s and 1980s, were really pushing to treat disability as a status that is entitled to equal rights. You know, so I think a lot of people would say a person, Ed Roberts from California, who went to University of California at a time when it was inaccessible. He was one of a very few students with disabilities who got in, basically got in on a ruse, didn't let them know that he had a disability. He had had polio, was forced to live in the hospital, actually, when he was a student, and who was this indefatigable activist and organizer who basically created with a lot of other people, but with a lot of his own efforts, the California-based disability rights movement made Berkeley accessible in many ways, recruited disability rights activists from around the country and budding disability rights activists, people with disabilities who wanted to claim their rights to California, to come to Berkeley to be a part of this movement. You know, and I think he's one of the people many people would say is a great hero. Judy Heumann, who was denied a job as a school teacher in New York because she had a disability. And the school at the time, this was in the early 70s, said, well, you can't control the class if you have a disability, so obviously we're not going to hire you. And, you know, started an activist organization there, was eventually recruited to join forces with the folks in California, and, you know, is now an appointee of the Obama administration, bringing disability rights to the world. You know, I think another one of the great heroes, you know, and it is bipartisan. I mean, so another one of the great heroes who I think of is a guy, Evan Kemp, who was a Republican, who had polio, or who had muscular dystrophy, actually, and when first came to prominence, actually, in the early 1980s, when he challenged the narrative of the Jerry Lewis telethon.
What's the matter with Jerry Lewis? He seems like a nice man. Why? What was that about?
Well, you know, so this was very controversial in the world because I think most people in America kind of had that attitude about Jerry Lewis, that, you know, he's raising money to do nice things for people who are unfortunate. And what Evan Kemp and other people who had been poster children, literally poster children for Jerry Lewis and Muscular Dystrophy Association said was, look, this is treating people with disabilities like they're objects, like they're inherently limited, like they're not people who can participate fully in the world. Like the thing that you want to do is give them charity, not enable them to participate as anyone else in all the aspects of society. So Evan Kemp, you know, became a lawyer and worked with an organization that was within the auspices of the Ralph Nader world to bring disability rights to America, and challenged Jerry Lewis to say, listen, what you're doing, which is sort of driven by these images of people with disabilities as being unable to do things, as people with disabilities as the only thing you can do is provide something to help them out and maintain them in their pitiful condition, that's not the right way to think about disability. The right way to think about disability is we might have to make accommodations in the way we build buildings or the way we design jobs or design educational programs to enable people with disabilities to participate. But once we do, people with disabilities can participate fully. He became a very important figure, actually, in making sure the ADA happened. So he was a Republican when President Reagan and Vice President Bush came into office. One of the first things they did is they looked around for regulations that they could get rid of. They had this early regulatory reform agenda. Vice President Bush was in charge of that agenda, and one of the first targets of the regulatory reform was an early set of laws requiring non-discrimination and accessibility by organizations that receive federal funds, and they were going to get rid of those laws. And what Evan Kemp did is he went to Vice President Bush and his then counsel, Boyden Gray, and worked with them and said, look, this is something you as a Republican should support, because what people with disabilities want is not to be maintained through charity or welfare. What we want is rights. We want to participate fully in the world. And that was an argument that resonated with Gray and with Bush, who became major advocates and are to this day major advocates of disability rights. Once Bush became president, he obviously struck and signed the ADA in 1990, and he appointed Evan Kemp to head the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, which was one of the major agencies enforcing the ADA.
One of the stories about Evan Kemp, which I'll probably get slightly wrong, was when he graduated from law school, he couldn't get a private firm, even though he was quite a good law student record. He couldn't get a private firm interested. He went and he worked for, I believe, the Securities and Exchange Commission. He had trouble getting from the outside parking garage to his office, and they refused to accommodate that. But he could sort of, I think they allowed him to be, he could enter by the garage door into the building. And at some point, the garage door he got hit by the garage door and became further, it worsened his disability. And he was then wheelchair bound. And at that point, I believe he was denied a promotion because of the fact that he was in a wheelchair, which has a sort of Kafkaesque. You mentioned this is wonderful new book, Enabling Acts, by Leonard Davis, which I've got to master, which sort of tells these stories. And you know, it was sort of a Kafkaesque bureaucratic case of mistreatment, and he sued and won, I believe. But this was the environment the pre-ADA environment.
You know, I mean, so there are just so many stories like that. A late friend of mine, Paul Miller, who was also one of the leaders of disability rights advocacy in the 1980s, he graduated from Harvard Law School in 1986, had a very good record at school, and no law firm would hire him. Why? Because he had dwarfism. And the hiring partners said, look, we don't want our clients to think that we're running a circus sideshow around here. It's just just said that to his face. That was the degree of overt discrimination and prejudice that existed. He wanted to work at a private law firm, but became one of the leading disability rights lawyers in California and in America. Did major work to both enforce the early anti-discrimination laws, but also help make the ADA happen and enforce the ADA as an appointee of first President Clinton and then President Obama.
I must say, you mentioned there's someone with dwarfism on our campus who's a very successful professional, and some of the issues that she has, I don't know this person personally, but remind me, we got some ways to go on the physical accessibility front. I remember I was once on the train with this person, and that's just a very heavy door to the cars that you have to open, and for reasons that are baffling to me, they put this door that really requires adult strength to open, if you go to our 59th Street station at the University of Chicago, if you were in a wheelchair, there's no way to get downstairs. And it's been 25 years since ADA, and this is the stop that says University of Chicago.
Right.
So we certainly, we've made so much progress on ADA, but wow, there's, I'm sure that if I had a mobility limiting disability and I actually started moving around in the world, I would quite easily come up with a very, very long checklist on the first day of things that are not done properly.
Yeah, I mean, you go to any city in America, you go to, you know, I mean, if I go to downtown Ann Arbor, I could probably within a block find five violations of the ADA. And that's true. You know, there's still a lot more that needs to be done. I think, you know, transportation has always been such a crucial issue for people with disabilities just to participate in the world. You know, the old slogan was of the disability rights movement in the 80s was, well, at least Rosa Parks could get on the bus, you know, so and the fight was to be able to have accessible buses and accessible trains and train stations. And we still have that. You know, the Department of Justice just a couple of weeks ago issued an extensive letter of findings, finding that Amtrak is violating the ADA. Here we are 25 years after the ADA. They still haven't come into compliance. So, I mean, there's a lot more work to do.
There. By the way, you mentioned some of the, although there are issues with the physical accessibility, there's been enormous progress. Employment has been much harder. Why has, there was the hope when ADA was passed that it would lead to a much higher degree of integration of people with disabilities in the workforce than has happened, it seems to me. And what are, why is that such a difficult challenge, or why was ADA not able to deal with that problem as effectively as people had hoped?
Yeah, I mean, I think the biggest issue is, you know, the group of people with disabilities is a very diverse group. It's a very large and diverse group of people, you know. So, I mean, depending on how you define disability, which is one of the problems, you know, it's upwards of 50 million Americans, maybe more. And within that group, you know, there are some people who were denied jobs before the ADA because of just prejudice or just stereotypes, you know. So my friend Paul Miller, that was an example of that. Outstanding lawyer, just law firms wouldn't hire him because of prejudice or stereotypes. And the ADA has been very good, I think, if you parse the statistics, in getting jobs or better jobs for people who were losing them because of prejudice or stereotypes before. And I think, you know, the most careful efforts at measuring this have shown that people who identify as having a disability, who have some physical or mental condition that may count as a disability, but that doesn't limit their ability to work, have actually done better. The problem is, you know, so the ADA also requires, as I was talking about, reasonable accommodation, requires that when an employer is considering someone for hiring, they have to make sure that their buildings and their jobs aren't unnecessarily designed to exclude people with disabilities. You know, it's not saying we change everything in the world, but if we have the way we do things that was designed without people with disabilities in mind, and it'd be easy enough to change it, we ought to do that to guarantee that people with disabilities should be included. And the evidence suggests that people whose disabilities impose significant limitations on their ability to work without accommodation have not done very well by the ADA. A lot of dispute about what exactly the numbers are. And my view has always been about this, that a big part of the problem is that there's this enormous population of people with disabilities who never even get the opportunity to go and apply for a job and be discriminated against and invoke the ADA, you know. So it's people who are still stuck in their homes because they don't have personal assistance services or attendant care that can enable them to get out and into the world. It's people who are living with the limitations of transportation that we still have. You know, healthcare is still a big problem too. I mean, so one of the obstacles for a lot of people with disabilities, and I think it continues after Obamacare, although hopefully Obamacare will mitigate some of this, is the kinds of services that provide supports for their particular disabilities, you can basically only get on Medicaid. And once you take a job that makes enough money for you, then you can't have Medicaid anymore. And, you know, there have been a lot of efforts to tweak the laws governing Medicaid to try to make sure that people don't lose their Medicaid when they go back in the workforce, at least for a sufficient period of time. And those haven't really worked in solving this problem. And I think part of it is people know when they lose Medicaid, it's really hard to get back on. Now, hopefully with Obamacare expanding Medicaid, that'll help in the places that have expanded Medicaid. But I think that's still a major barrier. And of course, the health insurance that people get on health insurance exchanges may or may not provide the kinds of services and supports that are necessary for people with significant disabilities. And so it's a real risk.
By the way, on the Medicaid front, a couple of things. First of all, many of our viewers might not realize there's many flavors of Medicaid. And Medicaid is in many ways several different programs. And so if you come onto Medicaid just because of Obamacare, because you're a low-income adult, many of the disability supports that you might need are not part of that flavor of Medicaid. Yeah. At the same time, if you are on SSI and you have Medicaid that covers these types of supports, you're subject to a number of restrictions that the other people are not. And so I don't know if you're familiar with my friend Joe Entwistle, who goes by Wheelie Boy on Twitter. And
sure.
Joe is a health policy analyst who's actually on SSI. He actually has a very good job, and he has his own personalized eligibility threshold that allows him to receive Medicaid services. He doesn't receive any cash assistance from SSI, and he makes too much money for that, but he has a personal attendant and other services that SSI in Wisconsin provides to him. He also cannot have more than a couple $1,000 in assets ever.
Right.
And so his life has been fundamentally both enabled by Medicaid in some ways, in many ways, but also fundamentally constrained in a very cruel way. By things like, you know, this asset requirement does not apply in the other part of Medicaid that the Medicaid expansion we think of as associated with Obamacare comes with. And sort of the level of complexity of that, first of all, there are many problems with it. And secondly, it's very bewildering for individuals. Joe is a really highly skilled person with a lot of professional experience in social services. And in fact, he counsels people and speaks, you know, he's a policy analyst in this area. If you are just a guy, it's very intimidating. You know, so, for example, there are many supports you might be able to get on Medicaid, or you might be able to get through SSI or SSDI, but you have to be confident enough that it's going to work for you, and you have to be willing to take a certain chance that the bureaucracy is going to do what it's supposed to do. And if I'm sitting on Medicaid and I'm not working, but my needs are being met, and I have this chance to get this job, like, what happens? What if I lose the job and I have to get back on Medicaid? Is that actually going to work? You can imagine how people are going to just be very risk averse about messing with that. And even if in principle there's a way to do it, there's lots of ways where it's just not going to happen, or I'm going to be just afraid that it's not going to happen, and therefore it's going to be hard for me to take advantage of opportunities that might be there for me.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. You know, and often you have people who went through a period of time where their needs for support weren't being met, and it took them a lot of work to get to something that seems stable and seems, if not perfect, at least acceptable. And so there's even more risk aversion in potentially losing that and going back to something that's much worse. And, you know, and it is bewildering. I'm a well-trained lawyer. You know, I've worked on these Medicaid issues for 20 years, and my eyes glaze over. I have a really hard time kind of parsing through all of the different options and all the different rules. And of course, they're different in every state. So I do think that's a big part of the issue here.
By the way, the inability to move across state lines. You know, as you know, my wife and I take care of her brother, Vincent, who's intellectually disabled, and he receives Medicaid services and other services. Illinois is actually very problematic. Like right now, there's no state budget, and the organizations that take care of Vincent are not being paid at the moment, although perhaps they're being paid the overdue bills from last year that the state is still owes them in the in the way of Illinois. But you know, if we had to move out of state, he would be bereft of services. And it took us about 6 months to get him onto Medicaid when we moved him into the state. And Illinois, I don't think is any particularly worse than any other state. It's just it's complicated, and there's just all of these ways that if you're not living this life, that would be invisible to you, but that really constrain people.
Yeah.
By the way, another thing you mentioned about the employment barriers, the employer has a number of responsibilities to make reasonable accommodation. But it's not exactly clear who's responsible to make sure that you could actually get to the job site to even be able to take advantage of whatever the accommodation is. And so, if you were to try to improve the employment situation of people with disabilities and you saw that gap in ADA, what are some things that we might do that would be helpful?
Yeah, I mean, I do think, something that I think that healthcare and transportation are kind of the two biggest issues. And I think something that provided a very clear entitlement to the kinds of services that people with the disabilities that are most obstacles to participating in the world need would be an important thing to do. A lot of this is really outside of the ADA. A lot of it is much more about simplifying and expanding our publicly provided healthcare systems. To me, that's sort of the wave that disability rights activists have to be thinking about pushing. I do think transportation has always been a bedeviling problem. And, one of the issues is that it's especially expensive in transportation facilities to retrofit them to make them accessible. Public transit in this country is, cash starved, and it doesn't reach a lot of people anyway, right? So I think you confront all of those issues. And I think there's no way to solve some of these issues without real public investment. That's not something we see happening.
There an investment that has to take place with government and also entities that it's not exactly clear what the home address would be to even give the money to
yep.
do this from the federal perspective. It's sort of just a very complex logistical problem. Is the disability rights community coming together around an agenda around particular legislation that might deal with this? Are there a couple of issues that people are trying in a coherent way to push right now?
Well, I don't know that there's a big legislative agenda on stuff like that at the moment. I think in part because having a legislative agenda on almost anything in D.C. Feels like a fool's errand right now. I think the efforts to push transportation accessibility continue to be very significant. I think both in terms of litigating under the ADA because there is such widespread violation and lobbying the various federal agencies to try to do what they can. I think that's sort of what people are trying to do right now. I think the other big area that we haven't talked about, but is so important for many people, is making cyberspace, the internet, accessible. So many of the opportunities for education and employment and recreation are on the internet right now. And, if you're blind or if you're deaf or if you have various kinds of physical or cognitive disabilities that make it difficult to maneuver through the internet, you can be excluded from those opportunities, those educational, employment, and recreational opportunities. And so I think you have begun to see a lot more litigation around this issue, but also there are important gaps in the ADA that a number of groups, notably the National Federation of the Blind, have been really focusing on trying to figure out a way to craft legislation around. So the ADA says that if I'm a university, I have to provide an accessible means of delivering my educational content to someone. So if we have an online course, it has to be captioned. It has to be edited in a way that is navigable by someone who's blind. But and there's currently litigation around that involving Harvard and MIT. But there's nothing in the ADA that says that manufacturers of smartphones or of computers or of other kinds of hardware need to make them accessible, need to build in accessibility features. And so, you know, there's some focus on how do we make that happen.
Yeah, I'm just thinking about my iPhone here, and I'm just thinking, like, how would I use it if I were blind? I mean, the entire thing is a touch screen,
yeah,
with visual icons. I don't even know what the – maybe there is a whole accommodating technology that I just don't know about.
Well, so a lot of it is you know, having text-to-speech and having commands that you can use to get to navigate the screen without touching them. Apple actually has been quite good about accessibility issues. They seem to have taken the issues very seriously. You know, other entities have been less so or have dragged their feet a little bit. You know, one of the big instances of this was when Amazon went to a bunch of universities and said, we're going to give you free Kindles to incorporate in your educational programs. You know, a lot of people who are blind thought, well, this could be really great, because if you're blind and you go to college, the way historically you've gotten Braille text or accessible text is you sign up for your classes, you find out what the books are, and the university buys the books, sends them off somewhere to be ripped apart and turned into Braille and then sent back to you. And usually there's a real delay. And so a lot of people who are blind, you know, would take a month and a half to get their texts. If you have a Kindle, it's actually totally easy with text-to-speech and with spoken commands and with audible commands to maneuver around a Kindle and get the same information as everybody else at the same time as everybody else. But at the time, what Amazon did is it didn't have the navigable menus for people who were blind. It was a very easy thing to do, but they just didn't do it. And so the Department of Justice, the Department of Education went to all these universities and said, listen, you really can't do this unless you have some kind of accessible means of enabling everybody to access the content. And, you know, in part, that was an effort to get around the fact that nobody could go to Amazon directly and say, this is really easy. I mean, it's just like building a ramp in a building. Do this to make your Kindle content accessible.
But it has no legal, you can't sue Amazon and say that you should have excluded this as a feature.
Right. There's no legal basis at the moment to sue Amazon. So you have to sue the people who use it. And, you know, there's ways of putting public pressure on folks like Amazon. And I think what Apple's decided is there's actually a big market. You know, so it's not just something they do because they're required to do it, but there's a whole bunch people who are blind who have other reasons why they can't use the touch screen as well as anyone else, and they actually will be a good market for their iPhones. And I think, you know, part of it is combining the legal aspect of it with convincing the businesses that it's in their interest.
It seems enough of a at least feasibility.
So
there's a reason to do it that makes it. It's not costly, and there's some potential upside to your conversation. It does a little weird that my smile couldn't make a commercial decision not to put a ramp in.
Right.
You know, that's just sorry, dude, you got to do it. And, you know, it's I remember when I was an engineer, there was a little discussion, like, how many women's bathrooms should we have? You know, I mean
oh, sure.
These things to people's commercial decisions, you know, we really would end up with a very segregated world. There was the argument, well, we only have a few women engineers, you know, do we really need to build the same number of women's bathrooms as men's bathrooms? And those organizations do need to be pushed.
Absolutely.
Comfort zone. But one of the things that strikes me talking to you, I'm sorry, I'm jumping around a little bit in this conversation, is how my own view of disability policy is so incomplete because I've been in one little corner of it, and in the intellectual disability corner, which first of all is much more focused on the caregivers as the key constituents and agents of change than people living with disabilities themselves in many cases, and also just has a different set of challenges, and Vincent moves around quite well in terms of his physical capacities. But you've also been quite involved in intellectual disability and litigation, and also in policy analysis and writing. How does the ADA impact people with cognitive issues who are physically able to access the world?
So I think it's made a big difference in a number of ways, although there have been limitations. So, you know, the biggest difference is that the ADA has given advocates, some with disabilities, some who are caregivers or parents, or other people who just have an interest, tools to create and get funding for really robust and good community-based services. You know, so we have this long-term trend in this country beginning in the 1950s of reducing the size of state institutions for people with developmental disabilities and other kinds of disabilities. So yeah, I think the peak date for the population of state institutions for people with developmental disabilities in America is around 1965. Before that point, you know, if you had a child who had an intellectual disability or a developmental disability, you were often told by your family doctor, the only thing you can really do is send your child away to live his or her entire life in the state institution. And, you know, there weren't really a lot of services in the homes and communities of ordinary people to make any alternative really work. And so you could sort of understand why parents often made these very anguished decisions about their children. Mm-hmm. Starting in the 1960s, you start to see a lot of parents say, well, I don't really like this. I mean, I think that's part of the rights consciousness of the time. I think that we ought to be able to provide my kid a chance to grow up with everybody else. And a number of laws get passed to try to move that along, to create educational opportunities in the 1970s. But one thing the ADA does is it says states have an obligation, if they're providing services to people with disabilities, to provide those services in the most integrated setting appropriate to the individual with a disability. And what the Supreme Court and a lot of lawyers and activists have done is taken that provision and said, what this means is, state, if you're spending all this money on institutional care, it could be in a big state facility, it could be in a nursing home, it could be in a large group home, what you should be doing is making sure you're spending that money actually in a way that is fully in the community, as fully as possible given their individual situation. And what that's led to is, around the country, states being pressed to move, but ultimately deciding it's a good idea to move to systems where people can live in their own homes or live with a roommate or live in a small group living arrangement and get the services and supports they need to live their lives and participate in the community there, instead of being stuck in the places where they were stuck before. And I mean, I know that that's something you experience in your life with Vincent, that this can make a real difference to people. You know, sort of one of the themes we've been talking about is the bipartisan nature of the ADA. One of the couples who I've gotten the chance to know through my disability rights work is Dick and Ginny Thornburg. Dick Thornburg was, you know, President Reagan and Bush's attorney general, governor of Pennsylvania. His wife Ginny, they have a son with an intellectual disability, and they've been really stalwart disability rights advocates since before the ADA. And one of the things that Ginny said to me is the difference that the ADA and moving to a place that was not an institution meant for her kid was that he could decide when to turn the light off at night. You know, and it's stuff like that. It's deciding when to turn the light off. It's deciding who you're going to have a meal with. You know, deciding what movie you're going to go to, instead of living in a place where everybody gets on a bus and they all go off to the same movie, or they all go off to the same shopping mall together, just doing the things we all take for granted. And, I've talked to a lot of parents, but also a lot of people with intellectual disabilities themselves, who think that that's really central to them. And the ADA for tens of thousands of people has made a difference. So has made that kind of a difference. So I think that's a very big deal. Now, obviously, again, lots of limitations, but you know, that's a real human benefit of what the ADA has done.
By the way, we should mention the Olmstead decision, which is probably the most important Supreme Court decision nobody's ever heard of outside of, which was really what said that people have a legal right to be in the least restrictive environment. And Justice Ginsburg deserves a lot of credit for writing that. And we should give her a nice retirement party so that as soon as we can make sure we can reload with someone of similar values. We can. But I should say, by the way, in our own life, that making that community integration happen is a little bit more subtle than a lot of people realize. Vincent lives in a community setting in a group home. A lot of group homes like Vincent, if you actually look at the daily lives that people have, it's not that integrated.
Yeah.
They go to a sheltered workshop. They go out they get on a little van instead of a big bus, and they all go to the movies. But if you say, who are they interacting with? How, you know, what kind of life are they really having in the community? It's more segregated than many of us would like to admit. And the difference in everyday living between say, Misericordia in Illinois here, which is a more institutional setup, and many of the group homes in Illinois is really on the ground is not that great in terms of actually being out, being able to do things. And so we have this real challenge to make that integration real. Is you know, it's more than just getting somebody into. It's good to be housed on a human scale, but that's only one dimension.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the things that advocates have really been focusing on recently. I mean, so I think the initial focus, and for a long time, the focus was just where do you live? You know, so are you living in a place with a lot of people with disabilities or fewer people with disabilities? And I think one of the things actually the Olmstead decision did is get people to focus on, it's not so much where do you live, it's how do you live? Are you living in a way that is as fully a part of the community as you can be, you know, that allows you to interact as fully as everyone else with all the options that people have, you know, for recreation, for participating in society, for everything else. And I think, you know, that's led to a new focus on things like, well, why are so many people going off to sheltered workshops? You know, they get on the bus, and I've seen this too, right? So people leave their group homes in the morning, the bus pulls up, they get on the bus and go to the sheltered workshop. Sometimes they do work there. Sometimes they do, you know, what's called different things in different states, you know, day habilitation, which is a lot like if you went to the old institutions, what used to happen in the day rooms of those old institutions. So, you know, now it's two different buildings in two different places, not one. Is that really any better? And I think a lot of people say no. I mean, so that's one of the really important focuses of ADA right now.
There is it's really. The other thing, by the way, is you need to have a little bit of money in your pocket. And so here in Illinois, I've mentioned to you this issue before, and I'm sure you've seen it. If you live in a group home, you get a personal allowance. And even that term allowance is a little bit insulting. This is for everything that's not part of the basic package of your necessities. So everything from socks and underwear to a dental visit that's not covered in your insurance to a medicine to a t-shirt or a hamburger or movie ticket. And so for 20 years in Illinois, it was $50 a month. They raised it to $60. They've now reduced it back to $50.
Yeah.
And, you know, Vincent, because he's connected with us and because of his mom left a trust, properly designed trust for him, he can do things. So he and I went to the Cheers bar in Boston. You know, he goes on vacations and people treat him really terrifically on these. But it's like, you know, all these things that you have to do out in the community, you actually need to have a little bit of money to do. And if you're at a sheltered workshop and you're paying and you're essentially earning $0, I mean, they receive a paycheck, but it's maybe $10 for a week or something. You know, it's often sort of a nominal amount. You're also limited in that way because you can go to the mall, but you got to be able to actually buy something at the mall. Although it's not a fun place to go visit, and I think that's an issue that there are all these practical things like that we've done a poor job on, and that we spend so much money on people with disabilities within their healthcare and in other ways, And then at the margin, there are these things that would increase their autonomy, which we skimp on in a way that is sort of petty inhumanity is sometimes really striking.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And you know, some people talk about that as, you know, we've gotten out of the institution, but we haven't gotten out of the institutional mindset. I mean, the idea that, well, we'll give someone an allowance and really nickel and dime them on the allowance. And you know, part of that also is ties back to the employment conversation. So one of the things that we're coming to know is there's a substantial fraction of people, even with quite significant intellectual disabilities, who can do productive work with appropriate supports. Now, it's more support than, you know, the ordinary reasonable accommodation. But if you look at all the money that's going into sheltered workshops, for example, it actually would make a lot of financial sense in many cases to provide those kinds of support for people to work in the competitive integrated workforce, actually do something that's remunerative, that's productive for society and good for them, and enables them to get some money in their pocket. Now, the problem is we don't know how to identify in advance who are the people who are going to benefit from this. And I think, you know, states throughout the country are moving kind of slowly, but inexorably moving toward more focus on real employment with appropriate supports instead of this kind of sheltered work model where you see someone, they get paid by the piece often. Sometimes it's stuff that matters in the economy, but it's not actually all that productive or helpful, certainly not tied to a person's individual abilities or to training people to work in jobs that really exist out in the world. And so I think you're seeing a move there.
But I commend people watching this who are interested. You have a wonderful article in the journal called Democracy that talks about some of these issues. I must say it's a little bittersweet for me to read that piece because, you know, Vincent is going to be 50, and I think it'd be hard for him. He's in a setting where there's a lot of monotonous work done, and he tends to wander away from the, partly because it's boring. He sort of wanders away from the putting things in boxes and sort of the rote. I think it's hard for him at this point in his life cycle to develop some of the capacities that when he was younger would have been a little bit easier to do. And, you know, we are sort of trying to figure out ways to allow him to advance himself. Because he wants to be a bartender at Cheers. He's told me that. He, you know, we were there. He's like, you know, he really wants to do that. And I mean, he has his idea of what that job is a little bit more like Beverly Hills 90210 than the mundane reality probably would be. But he wants to be a man, you know, with everything that. And it's hard at this point because of his generational, because of just how old he is. I think younger people now have many more enrichment opportunities than he was accorded, although he was blessed. I think if he'd been 10 years older, he would have been in an institution, which is where my in-laws were advised to place him, you know, as a child. One of the things that you also have written about, actually in that same piece, is when we speak of the life cycle, is this notion of the disability cliff. And I thought that was quite an important thing. Maybe we should close out our conversation with that. What is the disability cliff?
Well, so we do really well. I mean, we have, a lot of limitations, but on balance do really well in providing services and supports and education for people with disabilities up until the time they age out of schooling. So we have a law, the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, passed in 1975, guarantees everyone with a disability the right to a free, appropriate public education until they're between 18 and 22, depending on the state. And, you know, that was a really important law because before that time, you had a lot of people, dispute about the numbers, but a lot of people who were just excluded from public school because they were treated as uneducable. So now we have a requirement that people with disabilities get educated and that includes everybody with a disability. So you have people with quite significant intellectual and cognitive disabilities who are in the school system who are supposed to be in the least restrictive environment appropriate to them, and in many cases are living their lives through their childhood and through their teenage years, being trained and prepared to be a part of the ordinary community the normal workforce. And then once they turn 18, 19, 20, 21, 22, whenever the services under that statute cut off, depending on the state, then they're just left in a world where they don't have any guarantees anymore. They've got to negotiate all the stuff you were talking about before, the very complicated mix of policies that are different in every state, often involve dealing with different agencies even within one state to try to cobble together some kind of services that enable these individuals who have been trained their whole lives to go live and work and participate fully in the community to actually do that. And so that's the cliff. And so when you talk to a lot of parents of kids with intellectual disabilities, you know, that's what they're afraid of. You know, so the services, obviously, you know, you talk to parents of these kids and, you know, throughout their childhood and teenage years, these parents are often very involved in advocating for their kids. It's not like it just happens automatically.
Yes.
But it more or less happens. And then when you get to the age of majority, then all of a sudden all these guarantees go away and you're really stuck trying as desperately as you can to pull something together. And as parents get older, particularly, I think they worry quite appropriately about their adult children with intellectual disabilities. How are those services going to be managed? And so I think part of what we need to think about is it sensible to have a system that is so well designed toward training people for full lives and then takes that away from them as soon as they're in a position to live those lives?
One of the things that's also so poignant in that, I so identify with that, is that if you in fact had a really clean handoff when someone was like 22 years old to whatever the next stage was, the system that we have now might be good, at least good for people who are, you know, well connected with, you know, for example, some of the really nice high schools in the northern suburbs of Chicago seem to do a nice job of this. The irony, by the way, is there's such an SES correlation, but it's not the one you want, where the people that get you hooked into the state services are the people that are the people in the nice high schools and so on. High SES parents are much more able to access services that are nominally rationed by need, but that are, for a variety of reasons, easier for people with more educational advantages and income to actually use. But if in fact, at age 22, we did all these big transitions, you could kind of make that work. But what actually happens in people's lives is, yeah, there's a set of transitions that you do when you leave high school or, you know, at that age. But then you go in, you know, life happens. You're doing something for several years and you realize, hey, I actually want to do something different. I have a new transition in my life that I'm 27. And then, you know, just life has lots of transition points. And all of a sudden there's nobody. So you get hooked up with a really nice employment opportunity at age 22. And then by age 25, you're ready for something different. Who's going to help you navigate that? Vincent, now he wants to move into a different group home. He's bored with – there's really nothing wrong with where he is now, but he's bored with it, and he wants to change. And it's really hard, and there's no life doesn't – we have this – the rest of America leads this prolonged adolescent life where there are kids coming, boomerang kids and all this other stuff, where we just all understand that if we're yuppies, that our children at age 25, we're helping them figure out their next gig. And that's where that disability cliff is especially problematic, because it forces you. It's as if you make that transition to adulthood and then it's done, and that's not the way life happens.
Yeah. No, I think that's exactly right. You know, our services aren't really, they're designed for these particular points, and you know that is not what life is. You know, and I think as we're trying to think about, how do we make sure that people with disabilities can live the same kind of lives that everyone else can live? We have to be attentive to that question.
And by the way, just to, in my caregiver-centric way of thinking about this, Rebecca Feinstein and I have been interviewing middle-aged and older people who are taking care of intellectually disabled children. And one of the wonderful things is that people with intellectual disabilities live a lot longer than they used to. And yeah, Most will outlive their parents. And so many, many, many of these people are either living in the family home or connected with the family in all sorts of ways that are that are quite valuable, but then the question comes up, what's the plan? And that it's all happening 20 years after the disability cliff has happened. So there's that system is gone. And also, in many states, services are basically rationed through crisis. And so, or at least your ability to present yourself to the bureaucracy as saying that you're in crisis and having an administrative narrative that triggers that. And so it's very, very hard for people to make a useful transition plan. You know, you can go visit, let's say your child's living in your house, you go visit a nice group home, you're not going to be able to get into that group home because you're currently, you're very low priority on the waiting list.
Yep.
And so why, you know, which really discourages the effort to plan because you're going to go and see a bunch of stuff that isn't going to be relevant to you when the time comes. And so we haven't figured out how to assist people in a humane way with just some human realities of aging and caregiving. Right now there's about 855,000 people with intellectual disabilities who are living with a caregiver over the age of 60. And now many of those caregivers are very healthy and many of those families have good plans, but a very high percentage of them don't. And you know, if you go to the supermarket, sometimes you'll see an older person with their adult son in tow, and their adult son is sort of getting the things off of the high shelf and helping the helping the parent, and the parent is helping the child, and it's a beautiful thing to see, but it's also a very poignant and scary thing to see because you have to wonder, how is this family? Who's helping this family? And there are also other issues like, we have many stereotypes about intellectually disabled adults. It's very challenging to be a caregiver. There are issues. Some of the people that we talked to had been injured by their adult children and things like that. It seems to me that that's another, we have to be thinking in a life cycle way that we've not figured out how to do at this point, would be the upshot of that, of what I'm learning in this project.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think if you think about like the group of people who are kind of getting to that certain age in community settings right now as, you know, the ADA generation, right? They're just beginning to confront these issues and it's frightening. It's absolutely frightening. And the point you make about the way that states ration services by crisis is absolutely right. I mean, so for, and it's one of the problems that we still have, and it's really a Medicaid problem, that Medicaid is designed that, you know, if you have a certain degree of service need, you can pretty much automatically get a slot in a nursing home. Now, the nursing home is almost certainly not going to be the best place for you in a lot of ways, but you can almost certainly get that slot. Whereas if you have that same level of need and could be served in a group home or in some other place that provides a little more service and support, you usually have to wait until you're in a position where it's going to be really horrible if you don't get it right away because there are such long wait lists for these services. A lot of states do treat people who have caregivers above a certain age as part of that emergency or priority category to try to smooth this issue a little bit. But, you know, it's really hard. And I think that is probably the next wave issue that we're really confronting right now.
Remember, I was talking, I led a focus group and there was a woman whose son is pretty severely impaired. He's in a diaper and he has a number of needs of that sort. And she got a call from someone in social services and said, "Are you in a crisis?" And she said, "Well, I'm not in crisis, but I could use some help."
Right.
All the other parents were like, "No, that is the wrong answer. You tell them I am in a crisis." And I just don't know how much longer I can do this, etc. And they were all rehearsing for her what she should say to trigger the designation of crisis. And I was thinking, this woman's very proud of the care that she provides to her son, and she really doesn't feel that she's in a crisis, but she does. She has needs that need to be met. I know you've got a busy life as a professor at a large university in Ann Arbor. I don't want to end on a down note. I do think this is a wonderful anniversary to note the great accomplishment of the Americans with Disabilities Act, and probably because of people like you. I don't know if I know a single human being who's done more to actually help more identifiable people in the world than you have among the people that I know. And I think of all of the work that you did in the Civil Rights Division and the litigation that you've done. So this is a great moment to say congratulations for all the progress to not just you, obviously, but to a whole community, and to say it's worth it. This is something we really should take note of it and think of all the challenges we have to meet, but also take some satisfaction out of what's been accomplished.
Yeah, no, I think it's a big accomplishment. I mean, it's a big accomplishment of many, many, many people who really worked hard to come together, build a disability rights movement, try to get a law passed, but also try to change society and make sure that that law and, you know, and society caught up with each other. And I think that you know, there are so many more things to do, but I do think it's important to reflect on the importance of the achievement.
Absolutely. And I was thinking when I, on our vacation to Boston, when, as Vincent was joking with the TSA guys and turning down offers of a free magazine from a guy at a store who really shouldn't have been giving him a free magazine, and just maneuvering through, you know, we get to get on first on the airplane, which we don't really need to do, but which makes it a little easier. And just all of the ways that it is really kind of remarkable compared to the world that he was born into, where his parents were told that there was really no realistic alternative to an institution for him. And out of all the best motives, this was the advice that was given. And I'm so happy that advice was not taken by the courageous generation of ADA advocates, caregivers, disabled individuals who really did an amazing job. So,
yeah.
So thank you so much for this conversation.